Welcome to the mystical world we live in with Almi. This hour, you will receive powerful revelations of a world where mystery and miracles are commonplace. Here's your host, Almi.
Happy to have you on the show. We are doing The Mystical World We Live In, Discovering the Secrets of the Hidden Realms. We want the opportunity of hearing secrets and revelations of the mystical realms, and we have asked Rogier if he will yet again be part of the show, and he has compiled some interesting questions, he tells me, so we are up for it today. Rogier, let's start right in, my friend, and just anything you want to say.
All right. Well, we've had multiple questions over the past months, well, pretty much in the vein of the following. In your latest books, you unveil the treachery of beings you in previous books spoke positively of. Do you not feel the need to edit or change those books, or do you specifically leave them as they are?
Well, there are two things to consider in this. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the decision was to leave things as they are. Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry. I'm a little distracted. I have about 8 incredible bouncing lights through my room, unlike what I've seen before. They're extremely bright. So, anyway... I was talking about the books. So the first thing is that, first of all, the pressure on me to produce books is so enormous. For example, The Mysteries of Isis, which is the Opening the Doors of Heaven, Revealing the Mysteries of Isis book, the information came through simultaneously as I was receiving the information from the unicorns and the history keepers of the cosmos for the book, The Gift of the Unicorns. The previous two books, The Ring of Truth, the year 2006, I had to produce and publish. I published them myself, you know, which is a financial issue, but I had to publish 3 books. And The Secrets of the Hidden Realms was still in the printer when Mother gave me the instruction that I had to produce Ring of Truth within between August and by December 1, it had to be in the printer's hands so that light workers could know about the laws that had changed. In the middle of receiving it, the fairies contacted me and said that they would give me the priceless opportunity of being able to have their realms photographed and give us their magic for the Aruba Farina book. So, currently, I'm editing the Isis book. It should be ready for folks to buy in February. I've also finished writing the next book, about 98%, and I'm already getting the book after that. So, these vast libraries that have been closed to man for eons of time have opened. I have the ability to translate the records. The answer just is, how much time can I spend doing it? So, you know, where am I going to put my attention? Am I going to go back and put notices in books that listen, even though I thought Thoth was an absolute hero? He turned out to be villainous in that he had split himself, and his darker side was working one level up, while the Thoth on this end pretended to be a light giver, when he was, in fact, one of the 6 major perpetrators in the cosmos as a dark god. So, you know, I didn't know that till 7. So the point is, I either can spend my time producing the new and just acknowledge to myself that the older books crumb trail that the Hansel and Gretel leaves as they go into the forest. so that they know how they got where they are. The other advantage to that is that it traces my journey in a way that I know other major light workers have experienced. I have never been afraid to be wrong. I've just been really nervous about ignoring an opportunity to learn. I am not in the least bit invested in being correct. I am happy to admit my mistakes book by book by book. But it's a journey that you can walk through. And it develops a reader much the same way that I developed to the point that I am if they're one step behind, for example. And even if they are, for instance, not one step behind, they can go, aha, that happened to me. I see now why this happened. Because during this year, when she was misinformed about this, so was I. There's major parallels in lightworkers' lives. And as a result, it just was, all in all, considering the best to leave it in.
Yeah, and personally, I would, you know, coming to think of it, think that in terms of, you know, easing readers into certain revelations, it might even be better to leave it as it is. I mean, since one aspect of ascension does seem to be that people are learning that, you know, their religious and spiritual heroes were really actually quite different than what they seem to be. So
it's been a part of disillusionment, hasn't it?
Yeah,
but disillusionment is part of growing up. You realize that Santa Claus is not real and that there isn't a tooth fairy. And, you know, and those are painful days when that first, for you it would be Sinterklaas. But this was a painful day when you first figure out that it wasn't really Sinterklaas that left things by your shoes in Holland, you know. It's part of the growing up process. But, you know, Rogier, now that you say that, in addition to that, we have also got the fact that every single book has major truths in it that also are building one upon each other. And let's say today the assemblage point position of man changes. Well, we won't know what that means unless we know where it's been.
Okay, but maybe qualify the term assemblage point as well. But
yes, and this is the other thing that I would like to develop, because we have pretty large appendices on the books, you know, which I just print extra and I don't charge people for when we consider the book price, and so it's getting to be an expensive project, but it would be better if we have a glossary of these terms so that people can fly with us, because every book does have to pre-explain it.
Yes.
And that, you know, that does make it cumbersome for readers that have already mastered those concepts. But we have deliberately not numbered the books so that the right person will pick up the right book.
Okay, but what was your point about moving the assemblage point of...
the assemblage point, I was just trying to say that if I say that it's moved, unless you've read where it's been, and various things of how we got where we are, you know, it's hard then to understand what I'm saying. So the books lay a foundation, so that the more of a foundation is read, the more information we will pull in.
All right. Okay, well, next question is about something completely different. I'm actually personally not sure how much you know about this, but the question is if you know, or rather to ask, what exactly was the Philadelphia experiment, and if there have been similar experiments, and if they still affect us today.
The reparation for that was not finalized and done until the second week in November of 2007. In 2007, in that month, That actually is a major key point. A lot of the information we were given left out certain key point, you know, and as it is, it supposedly leaked out there. Now, this is not something I've paid much attention to, but it's, of course, leaked into my peripheral vision because I've spoken on panels with those that have been part of that Philadelphia experiment. In fact, New York, this was the last time I spoke on a panel with one of them, so I'm familiar with what you're speaking of. But the actual dates in November of 2007, that was a crucial and key point at which this could be used to bring healing to rifts in time. And what was, there were several things happening. The splitting of time and the looping of time. Splitting of time is taking a timeline and creating either a loop of it so that you can go off on a whole different tangent and live a whole different life and come back 1 second later with 15 years of experience because you did a 15-year loop. And for all intents and purposes, it would seem like you've never been gone. Well, that's a time loop. You can also split time, where you can be living two timelines at once. All of those things have done tremendous harm. One of the other things that did tremendous harm in why life has been in this information explosion and why life has sped up to the way that it has is that in the future, some of the world's, quote, superpowers, as they call themselves, discovered a way in which they could feed themselves information back in 1945. The splitting of the atom in 1945 is a key event in this. And it created a rift that rippled through time and space, and it made it impossible to loop further back than that. But they've been looping back and back and back to 1945, feeding themselves information. And it created a tremendous complexity of life because it was like living the same life over and over and over, but each time you add more issues in, you see. So it was making multiple partners, multiple husbands, multiple wives, multiple marriages, just many, many things, and becoming a tremendous burden and diluting the simplicity of living that allows us time for deep, meaningful living. This was only healed in November of 2007.
All right, but the looping back actually was ceased before that, right? Before November 2007. Or did it go on?
It was what?
It ceased long before 2007, didn't it?
No, it went on till that time.
Okay.
November of 2007.
All right. But do you know anything else about, you know, what's happened to people who've been subject to this kind of thing? Because I think that's actually what it's really wondering, what was the Philadelphia experiment itself. You know, because there's all myth about it.
There were many, many people lost in timelines. Basically lost in time. That part of it was healed, I believe, in 2004. I'm not sure if it was 2004 or 2003, but it was healed then. It occurred again. It was healed again in November. See, Earth is not the only problematic area with this, because what we've had is we've had star races with the ability to travel in hyperspace, which means they go out of the time-space continuum, and they can go 1 second out of it and come back and have, come back a thousand years later. So they've been going back and forth in time, making tears in the time-space fabric, if you will, and making tears of it. Like, I once asked a group of beings that spoke to me from the Pleiades, how long it took them to come from where they are to where we are. And they said, oh, 7 hours. I said, oh, that long. They said, yes, we go 3.5 hours away from our planetary system. The next instant, we go into hyperspace. Next instant, we're out of it. And we arrive 3.5 hours away from your planetary system as a courtesy to you. Because if we don't, we'd have a Bermuda Triangle situation where things disappear through this hole in the time-space continuum. You'll go to work and come back and your house isn't there. So that's why they kept making tears over there. But what they didn't realize, all these races doing the hyperspace traveling, is that the tears were starting to be a bit like a scene that I saw in, you know, I have an 8-year-old, so it's in Ratatouille, where she's firing, this little old lady is firing her gun at the ceiling, and it starts to crack the ceiling, and eventually she's firing, trying to hit one single solitary rat. But eventually, the whole ceiling falls down. The time-space continuum, it was starting to ripple its cracks right through. There were planets where things were regularly disappearing, and there were planets that were afraid of actually disappearing. And they had been contacting me, so, you know, I knew that that was a problem. Rogier, let's take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back.
The brand new book, The Gift of the Unicorns, is now available from Almeen. The magical book answers a question: do mystical creatures like the winged horse Pegasus, mermaids, and giants truly exist? What is their roles, and how can they be called upon for assistance? In their own words, the unicorns reveal where they went during the ages of darkness, their heroism in preserving purity and innocence, their golden shoes, and the secret mission they undertook for the mother of all creation. To receive your copy of this amazing book of sacred secrets, The Gift of the Unicorns, go to www.spiritualjourneys.com or call 502-499-0016 today. A Life of Miracles is a deeply inspiring and motivational book in its content. It is unique in its field in making man's relationship as the microcosm to the macrocosm understandable to both beginning and advanced readers. It's a detailed guide to living a joyous and balanced life that provides a carefully laid out map to achieving the magnificent destiny that beckons at the apex of human experience, that of ascension. If you're ready to ascend to a higher consciousness, begin each day with A Life of Miracles or any other books, CDs, lectures, workshops, or her magazine by contacting Almeen at www.spiritualjourneys.com.
Welcome back, and welcome back to you, Rogier, and please continue with whatever it is you want us to follow.
Well, all right. There's a question about Atlantis and Lemuria, and I think this is really about, doesn't seem to be much consensus about these two, civilizations. Either one came after the other, or they existed at the same time. And the question really is if you could briefly outline sort of the history of their interaction, if any, or did they come one after the other?
Yes. So, the origin of man is the issue. And the origin of man took place when Earth was in a completely different solar system. When multiple races were pulled together and given the instruction that it would serve their future purposes and in one way or another save their races if they contributed to forming the specific being. So they came together to form humanity, and the Orions told me of that, the way their records speak of how that happened. They say an emissary of the mother appeared to them and basically came and said, you need to go to Earth, you need to assist to form the body and the reptilian brain of this being that is to be made. So, the point is that they came, their part was the Neanderthal type beings that we find on planet were in fact created by them as a side experiment because they were trying to make the bodies tough of their own race, and they were trying to find a way in which that can be done.
But so they is who exactly?
That they're the Orions.
All right.
So the point is that what happened is that the Pleiadians came, gave artistic ability. The Andromedans came and they gave us the mental bodies. The Arcturians came briefly, and I'm not entirely sure what it is that they contributed. But multiple races did, in fact, contribute to making humanity. When that was done, it was on Lemuria. 7 root races were established. It is from the 5th root race, called the Ramuhal, that the Atlanteans came about. And I believe that the priest class of the Ramuhal were called the Tlavati, and they were the Toltecs. The Toltec Nahuals, of which I often speak because it's a mystical path that has been very instrumental in my life. But the Tlavati were dedicated to setting humans free from illusion. The souls that came into humans were the very, very ancient beings. They were some of the first creations of Mother. So Lemuria as a civilization absolutely predated Atlantis. So at that point, the 5th Ramuhal race became the Atlanteans, and Atlantis has had multiple times of destruction. There was a time that it was far more north. It was sort of to the east of New York, if you will. And then that went under. Then there was a series of multiple islands in the Atlantic Ocean. And at times the largest, some very, very large catastrophes happened. Like the ancient Toltec traditions speak of the Himalayas rising in a single day due to the fact that the massive crater, which our satellites have now discovered, is most of the Atlantic Ocean's floor. It's the largest volcanic crater on Earth, actually did erupt, and it erupted, thrusting tectonic plates against each other, shooting mountains up. The loss of life in what was a fertile valley where those two plates used to meet and then became the Himalayas was, according to Toltec traditions, some of the largest we've ever experienced. So, they speak about a wall of ice coming down when the Earth tilted, for example. That also happened when a comet struck the Earth. So we've had multiple Atlantises. The last one, which ended 9,564 years before the crucifixion of Christ. Now, the crucifixion of Christ happened 2,024, 24 years ago. So if you add 2,024 to 9,564, you have the exact date at which Atlantis sank. It sank in February, towards the end of that February. And the last islands went down East Coast time about 5:30 in the afternoon. And the last island to go down of Poseidonis, which is the name of the last Atlantis we generally refer to, was Undal. And Undal was where the halls of Amenti, the sacred temple, stood that Mother herself had built. Urdal was the island right close to it, where the scientists and the artists and so on dwelt. But Undal was the holy island, and they were on the north and the northeast, respectively, of Atlantis.
Okay, and but after, is there generally been one reason why it's been, why it has destructed multiple times, or is there been different reasons for this? Because, you know,
there have been different reasons. Some of it was done by Thoth's experimentation with weapons that he bartered for from other planetary systems. You know, Atlantis was a place where you usually could see, after he took over its rulership, you usually could see the, like there were blue beings walking in there from Andromeda and so on. He regularly had trade with them, and he always was looking for ways to conquer. And some of those weapons went awry. There was a very intense trade competition between Lemuria and Atlantis. And the information about that is given by the Cosmic History Keepers, and I took it down as dictation, and it's in the second half of the back of the Gift of the Unicorns. And then a renegade group set up a competition down in Patagonia, and they entirely destroyed that group, that population down there. They blew them out of the water.
Wow.
Rogier, let's take a few minute break, and we'll be right back after these advertisements.
In this, the fourth book, The Ring of Truth, which chronicles Almaine's journey, she tells of the promise and the potential inherent in the resurgence of the feminine principle, increasingly felt in all aspects of current human experience. The operation of new laws governing the cosmos are explained together with the reasons for their creation. We are introduced to Mother, the primal creative energy that pervades every aspect of existence. We learn of her love and her laws and how to incorporate them into every thought and act. We are given samples of her divine language, its meaning, and its power. Mother's great gift to humanity, the healing power of Belvaspada, is revealed. This new approach to dissolving disease of mind, spirit, and body replaces previously existing methodologies. Application of its techniques removes old barriers of physically oriented existence and opens a broad pathway to a life of joy and fulfillment. Discover Mother and the Ring of Truth, as well as all of Almaine's books, CDs, lectures, workshops, or magazine by logging on to www.spiritualjourneys.com.
Rogier, what else is there that you'd like us to talk about?
I take it we're done on the previous subject, right?
Well, unless there's more you want to know, I can go on about that for the rest of our show.
Well, I was...
wherever you want to go.
Well, let's take this one. In one of the previous shows, you mentioned the Urim and the Thummim, the seer stones.
Yes.
And I think probably people generally know that from the Old Testament, but... you also said something about it being related to your pineal, so if you could maybe expound on that one a bit.
Yes, I'll be happy to. The seer stone is a set of two stones that enable you to translate virtually everything. There are several sets around the world of these that I know of. One is in the Tibet, in one of their caves that, you know, they only the monks know. The other one is in Peru. There's one in Palmyra, New York, in the Hill of Palmyra, that is owned by the Mormons. There's one in Ayers Rock in Australia. Inside the rock, there's a whole library. So there's one in there. And then there was another one that I obtained. Mother wanted me to be able to translate records and languages. And so what she did is, instead of the cumbersome external technology of walking around with seer stones, the seer stones were internalized into the pineal gland, so that I could translate the ancient languages. I could write them, I could translate their writings or their verbal sounds. But that's what a seer stone does.
Okay, but then,
I was given one by Merlin, and this was internalized.
Okay, but the other ones you spoke of are really just actual stones, physical
stones.
Yes,
they are. And they're, you know, there's one that should be inside the Ark of the Covenant. It, too, is in a breastplate. Sometimes they were in a breastplate. Sometimes they were placed as a headpiece on the, with the stones on the forehead.
Okay. And sort of next related question is about Abraham. And there's also sort of not much consensus on, you know, who he was, if he was at all, of course. But I know some people would see him as a great prophet and others as like a warlord or an Anunnaki. Do you know anything about this being?
I've never really looked very closely, but I believe that, like Noah, he was one of the skeletons in the closets of the Anunnaki, and let me explain what I mean by that. First of all, for those people that are not familiar with Zachariah Sitchin's work, in which he translates Sumerian records that show that the Anunnaki came to Earth. Now, this was after the human race had formed, but the human race had mostly moved inside of the Earth because events that happened within the cosmos that the Earth was in at that time made it necessary. So eventually the Earth ends up in our solar system, and when the Anunnaki came, the first one that came was called Arulu. He was a deposed king of the planet of Nibiru. The planet of Nibiru, according to our Sumerian records, comes in an elliptical orbit in every 3,600 years to the other side of Mars. The problem for them was getting through the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt is in part where the other parts of it come from. We say very clearly in Secrets of the Hidden Realms in the History of the Cycles, which is the second part of the book. But
Albion continues the exploration begun in her previous books, A Life of Miracles and Journey to the Heart of God, probing further into the nature and meaning of existence. Secrets of the Hidden Realms introduces the readers to the goddess mysteries as they apply not only to individual human lives, but to the cycles of the cosmos. From this background in the intangible functions of being, Almeen is led into the dimensions of non-humans, interacting with creatures previously known only in myth and folklore, the inner relationships of fairies, dragons, gnomes, unicorns, and other elementals, and their influence on humankind is explained. Vivid accounts of encounters with these beings and others existing as expressions of the widely divergent vibrations illustrate the essential unity of all creation. Journeying from these subtle realms, the reader is shown the ultimate expression of humanity, evolution into God being. Secret of the Hidden Realms can be obtained from Almeen, along with her other books, CDs, workshops, lectures, and magazine by logging on to www.spiritualjourneys.com.
Well, we are covering right now some of the ancient mysteries, and I'm asking Rogier Chardé, who has prepared our questions for us, to where he would like us to go with all these things.
Well, we were actually still on the topic of Abraham and Anunnaki. I'm not really sure how far you got on that one.
Well, I'm I'm not either, because the technical difficulties we were having were interrupted. But the Anunnaki did inhabit the planet. They were the ruling class. Where the problem came in is when the ruling class mingled with beings that they had engineered genetically. And Noah is one such example, and although I have not looked at it properly, I believe Abraham was too. For instance, the two ruling brothers, the one ruled Africa, the other one was really in charge of the whole earth other than Africa, and the one was called Enlil, and he was the Yahweh of the Old Testament. The Enki was the other one. Enki, actually, apparently Noah's mother was very, very beautiful. She was married. He fathered Noah. And Noah was given by him. That's why he saved Noah when the flood came. And there was a tremendous uproar about that, because the agreement was that they wouldn't save any humans. But his excuse was, well, he's actually my son. But Noah was saved by Enki because of the fact that, you know, they knew that actually it was Antarctica that was going to, the ice was sliding off. And so there was, at later time, he gave him a plant that would keep him in rejuvenation so that he could live a very, very long time. Some of these older patriarchs that lived very long times, when you look at the lineages of Abraham, you go right back to Melchizedek, who lived for 900 years. They lived that long because they, in part, had Anunnaki blood. So Abraham was, in all likelihood, because of the personal guidance that he was given. And remember how his wife was still very beautiful when she was in her 90s. When they went to Egypt, the Pharaoh wanted his wife, and the wife, Sarah, was in her 90s, and she was still that beautiful because they had Anunnaki blood. And I believe that he possibly was a son of Enki's. Enlil did not mingle with humans. He only had as partners those that were Anunnaki. He was very opposed to it philosophically.
Okay, but just to be clear, did you say that the Anunnaki did or did not engineer humans? Because you said they were here already.
They engineered the smaller humans. The humans that are today come from that genetic engineering. The humans that many of them live on the inner earth that are the tall humans. There were 12-foot giants, and then there were 30-foot giants. And you even read about the land of the giants actually in Genesis, because some of them came onto the surface of the planet. But most of those live in the inner earth, in the hollow earth.
Okay, so
it came from Lemuria, way before the Anunnaki started to make, quote, man.
Okay, but they made man from that source material then that was on the inner earth.
How they made man exactly is as follows. The remember we mentioned that the Orions made a side experiment, and it was the Neanderthal-type beings. And they were creating them for toughness of body because they wanted to actually incorporate it into their own planet. Well, those beings remained on Earth. They were experiments that didn't work very well. But they remained on Earth. It was with them that the Anunnaki engineered. They tried everything. Then they tried to use the wombs of Anunnaki women, but it kept creating hybrids that could not produce. And they wanted them as basically hard laborer workers for the gold mines. And the gold was necessary because Nibiru's atmosphere was deteriorating, and they would ship large amounts of the Earth's gold to Nibiru, and they would pump it as powder into their outer atmosphere to safeguard their atmosphere. So they wanted them as workers. Enki writes, and this is a translation from our own Sumerian records called The Last Book of Enki, and E-N-K-I. And Enki writes in that last book that was translated by Zachariah Sitchin. Sitchin is S-I-T-C-H-E-N. That he was with his vizier, I don't know how you pronounce that word, on a boat trip on one of the African rivers when he found two of those primitive women on the side. And he actually copulated with them and watched, and for the first time, they became pregnant, which they had really struggled to do. They both became pregnant. One produced a son, and one produced a daughter. The son was Adam, and the daughter was Eve. And Adam, in the old language, in the Anunnaki language, means perfect man. And so then they mated them together, and for the first time, they didn't create a hybrid that couldn't reproduce. And then they started to populate and create these little people.
Okay, but then they, Anunnaki looked very much different from us then?
No, they didn't. They were about 7 foot tall.
But humanoid as well?
Very humanoid. No, not at all. The moon, the face on Mars, that's the tomb of Arulu, the ruler of the Anunnaki that was deposed and came to Earth as the first person to notice that Earth was habitable. That is his tomb there.
Wow. So then Anu wasn't the first one who got here?
Oh, Anu came much later. Anu, Arulu came, he got samples that with his computer, basically, he sent back to them out of seawater in the Middle East. And there is gold in seawater. There's, for instance, a technology out of Utah that will produce 2 cents of gold out of tap water. And, you know, it goes up in percentage with other water. It's a technology that they've developed there. But There is gold in water. It just wasn't productive. But he sent his son Enlil down, and he sent Enki down. They tried to produce enough gold out of the water, but it didn't work. And so finally they found gold in Africa. But the Anunnaki really resented having to do that hard work. And that's why they created man. Only later, when a whole civilization in the Middle East had been built up by Enlil, he built a small palace for Anu called Enkidu, which he gave to his granddaughter Isis, or Inanna, as they called her. The family actually called her Ishana, which means come from heaven. And her grandfather gave her that palace. The palace still stands. It just is one level up. And then he came in great pomp and great glory, and Leo rolled out the red carpets, but he had created a whole civilization. And
okay.
Enlil was Isis's father.
Right, even though she wasn't really from that family, but
no, and Osiris story. Was Enki's youngest son.
Okay, but there's actually a question about that, because now you mention Osiris, and previously you mentioned Orion, and in Egyptian traditions, the two of them are usually linked, but is there any validity to this one?
No. The soul, actually, if you trace the soul of Osiris, he was a very great avatar, if you will, on Nibiru that came into form.
Okay.
So he came from Nibiru, didn't come from Orion at all, so I don't know why they would link it.
No, me neither. Maybe it's just the...
What Osiris's job was after his death, because he did in fact die in that lifetime, what his job was is he was given the job to guard the entrance to the two, what used to be the two spirit worlds, which is Duat and Sekhet Hepspet. His oldest brother, Marduk, which we know as Ra of Egypt, was given the task of guarding the membrane and the gateway between those two spirit worlds where people go to when they died. So his job was the in-between one. He had an aspect of himself either side in both spirit worlds, and Osiris guarded the gate into the spirit worlds.
Okay. But, let's see, previously you mentioned Orion, and that's where we got the reptilian brain from, ultimately. Is that what you said?
Yes.
There's actually a question, second question about that, because it seems like Orion is a place where a lot of negativity has been going on. Is that correct?
Well, see, we've been speaking about the ascension process of the Earth, and that we have pulled all of creation behind us as we moved and ascended over the lip of space into what was empty space. And we've spoken about this on our other show, which is on at 8:55 Pacific time on Sunday nights, called Windows into Eternity, Understanding Concepts of Ascension. The planetary ascension started to lead a movement, opening gateways that contained the cosmos within a membrane, and all of the membrane was pulled behind it into an ascension. The configuration of stars in the sky that we see right now is like a movie screen that keeps a reality in place until the ascension has reached levels on which the goddess herself with the Father by her side will reside in what Revelations calls the New Testament.
But, New Jerusalem.
The New Jerusalem. Thank you. Keep me on the straight and narrow there, sweetie. So anyway, the fact is that most of Orion is gone. Many of the stars are not there anymore because many of those races and their planets were so non-life enhancing that we pulled them into oblivion as we moved from level to level to level.
Okay,
they're just not there.
Okay, well, I think actually, I mean, that's what the question was referring to then, when they were still around you, and actually the phrasing is if it was really such a criminal hotspot or if there were just also good things coming from Orion.
Well, it was both. It was both. The reason is that if you look at the belt of Orion, the middle star is actually a stargate. But the two stars on either side, the one had very hostile beings that were created by these black gods with no feeling bodies. They were created electrically only, Zeta Reticuli, the greys that for a long time abducted the brightest of the bright of the humanity in order to try and find a way to stop their own oblivion from happening. But The Zeta Reticuli was on one side. On the other side of the belt of Orion, the other side star, the most beautiful beings live there. I encountered them some years ago. They are, you know, our Earth's like a living genetic library in that we have the species of, in undeveloped form, of most primary species that are out there. Well, this side star is what our frogs would be if they were a primary species. They're, you know, they're humanoid-looking in that they're bipedal and so on. But they have these huge frog heads, and they're very large, they're about 10 feet. And they're extremely gentle, beautiful creatures. I had four of them come into my room one night, and the next day I had, we went for fun. I had my young son at the time and took him to a psychic fair because he wanted to go. And just for fun, we had an aura picture taken, and this big frog face is sitting right above me. I possibly still have the picture. I can show you. But those beings are very benign, very non-hostile. The only reason they survived so well is because of their ability to vibrate higher, so they would always go higher than the beings invading, and it would give them the advantage, and they would be invisible to them. Very beautiful beings. So it was a mixed bag, but it was very much a planetary system of great separatism, dictatorship. The weapons they used were weapons that would wipe the memories clean of the civilization they conquered. The weapon was called Mach, M-A-C-H, Mach. And, they just would wipe racist minds and then conquer them. So that was their weapon. And Arian, I speak the Orion language. Arian stands for Lords of the Heavens. And, the hounds at the feet of the Lords of the Heavens is Sirius star system, which they conquered most of it for a very long time with that weapon. Then they used them as their mercenary soldiers, and they used the weapon of what the Orions call duck, and it's cannibalism. They suck the energy out of their victims and enhance themselves, and basically the life force drains out and the others die. So, they had a lot of aggression.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay, well, I have another question about a constellation, but I'm not sure if we managed that before a break.
Yes, let's have a quick break.
After 3 months of intense physical preparation in January 2004, Almin experienced a transfiguration, entering the presence of the infinite for the second time since moving into God consciousness, the state of no longer identifying with the ego, in 2000. In the weeks that followed, the powerful revelations contained in this book emerged from that all-encompassing silence. Having lost most of her linear thinking during this transition, much of this book has been written without conscious thought. This form of automatic writing, like automatic speaking she now does, flows freely from source into her own handwriting from which it was transcribed. Few have entered into God consciousness to leave the bliss to teach. Still fewer in the stage of immortal master, and in addition, continue to function among the masses. But as a Toltec Nagual and seer, Almin's life is dedicated to leading others to complete freedom from mortal boundaries. Journey to the Heart of God is an opportunity of a lifetime to see through the eyes of one who has encountered the indescribable realms of eternity. From such a perspective come insights that can heal the deepest wounds of alienation found in human hearts. Journey to the Heart of God contains, no matter how profound, truth. Truth that can be recognized for what it is, and it is the truth that shall set us free. Pick up a copy of The Journey to the Heart of God and discover your personal truth and freedom through Almin's books, CDs, workshops, lectures, and magazine by logging on to www.spiritualjourneys.com. The Complete Power Of and the Mystical Key series of radio programs are a part of the Premier CD set. They are available from Almin at www.spiritualjourneys.com. Request the entire Premier CD series set or the new book, Aruba Farina, The Book of Fairy Magic, by calling 502-499-0016 today.
Welcome back with us. And we have about 5 minutes left here, which might be time for just one more question.
All right. Well, I'm just kind of hesitant now about the constellation question, but actually, we'll just see how long it takes. This is from a woman who feels a strong connection to the constellation of Lyra, and she wonders how it sort of, if you know anything about it, and how it relates to the history of our planet.
The Lyra star system was something that the Earth actually came through when she was shot on her path and actually traveled through the system of Lyra. And so as she was, the Earth did not originate in the star system, as we clearly explain in The Gift of the Unicorns. It came from a star system that the Egyptians call Kolob and Oblish, or Oleblish, Obelish, I think. And but the actual name for Obelish was Melaganiga. So it came from this binary star system where it ended up after the Big Bang. So in the star system of Obelish and Kolob, at one point it got shot out from there, and when the Earth was shot, she traveled multiple eons of time from star system to star system until finally she ended up here in the star system. She came through Lyra. What Mother did at that time is she transplanted, and Mother is the mother of all creation. She transplanted some of the fairies from the Earth to Lyra. And they kept some of the sacred centers of the cosmos there. The Lyra star system, if I remember correctly, held the crown chakra of the cosmos. And, for instance, Antares held the cosmic life force center, which is like the Haran chakra. And the Venus, for instance, held the heart center of the cosmos. So these various planetary systems held various cosmic centers. So Lyra held that. The only other thing that I know of Lyra, I have not ever communicated with anybody from Lyra, other than that I am very aware of a loop in time that was lived in what is our future. But to understand this, it was something we were going to live. It was something we did live, in that it's a loop. But the need for us to go back to that loop has been eliminated, like taking a belt with a loop and just pulling the belt straight and the loop is gone. In that loop of time, the Earth was involved in a big dynasty. And Lyra was one of the governing centers, along with Orion, which is the primary governing center of this dynasty. But it was invaded by the Pegasus star system and terribly destroyed. Planets were blown out of the sky. Races perished in the Lyra system, and some of them made it here. And some of them are a small group of bird race beings that made it into our inner Earth, but there aren't any longer any of them left. And so that's the best I can do about Lyra. I'm sorry, or Lyra as it's called. I have never encountered anyone from there that I have spoken with other than the fairies.
Okay, so, well,
you know, we might be at the end of our program. I'm not entirely sure, but Rogier, did you want to say one last thing?
No, I just want to say that it's probably much appreciated, whatever you know. So,
well, thank you so much for everything that you take the trouble to compile for us, and thank you too to our listeners. Until next time.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show, The Mystical World We Live In, with Al Mee. Please join us again next week.